Hello, this is John Amundson, and I want to welcome you to the next podcast in a series of podcasts presented for you by the Psychologists Association of Alberta. The purpose of the podcast is to present information as timely, topical, and controversial to the membership. I led in with something a little more sophisticated today. Dave Brubeck, Take 5. If you guys don't know Dave Brubeck, kind of find him. It's easy now. Music's everywhere, and you can hunt it up through everything from Apple through Spotify, and he was just very, very cool guy, late 50s, early 60s, a whole special sort of genre of jazz within the genre of jazz. And someone said to me, why don't you become a little more sophisticated, get rid of that vulgar music that you play? So there we go. Today is just a series of articles, and no particular theme other than stuff that's been acquired in my saving area on my computer or on my desk. And the first article I want to talk about is one that has made the rounds, and it's also been paralleled by other publications of a similar sort. There's a book out actually on this now, but it's this is a study that came out of psychiatry research, and saying that essentially psychiatric diagnosis is scientifically meaningless. Their argument is very simple in the article. It says there are four main points. One, psychiatric diagnosis all use different decision-making rules. In other words, the algorithms and the process of making a decision in psychiatric diagnosis can follow various patterns and different patterns with different individuals, and especially depending on their orientation to clinical practice. Second, there's a huge amount of overlap in symptoms between diagnoses. I'm going to quote Larry Butler. Larry Butler has developed the unified treatment approach to anxiety and mood disorders, and he says there's more in common in the treatment approaches than there is in difference, and what he's suggesting here is an overlap in sort of symptoms, or at least their phenotypic expression, behavioral expression in the individuals. Third, almost all diagnoses mask the role of trauma and adverse events, and I would add to this contextual circumstance that that the history of the organism relative to the expression of symptoms is often less taken into consideration than the actual just expression of the symptoms, nor is the context, a context which in fact permits the expression of symptoms, encourages the expression of symptoms, or makes possible the expression of symptoms. Finally, diagnoses tell us little about the individual patient and what treatment they need. This is a very important one. Because there is a concept between what we call formal and operational diagnosis. I'm trying to think. I think Nichols was the original guy who conceived this, but I've been hammering it for years. That I wrote an article called Tales of Suffering and Complaint, the DSM, at the end of the 20th century, and I just called it a collection of Tales of Suffering and Complaint. It was published in, I think, Journal of Systemic Therapy or something. Anyway, this particular approach says that naming it is very different from operationalizing it. So if someone is suffering from a major depressive disorder, that says very little about how you treat it. And as we all know, there are varieties of models that would tell us how we ought to treat that. So the operationalization is very different from the formal diagnosis and designation. So there's our first quick comment on and this is nothing new. This recycles every 5 to 10 years, this idea of the bankruptcy of the of diagnosis. As a matter of fact, Paula Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N, she wrote a book in the late 90s called They Say You're Crazy, and it was a very good polemic, a feminist polemic regarding a diagnosis and her desire to include in the diagnostic categories personality disorders. I want to say it's delusional dominating personality disorder, overly represented in men. Anyway, Kaplan, look that one up. Thank you. The next article, I really debated whether or not I should talk about it, but it was published in the American Psychologist of all places, so it's there's certainly a redemptive quality to it then, in that the American Psychologist, a flagship, it doesn't publish junk. And the title of the article is Who Watches an ISIS Beheading and Why? And they looked at a representative sample of U.S. residents, about 3,294, about exactly 3,294. And they did this over a 3-year longitudinal study. And 20% of the sample reported watching at least part of a beheading, and 5% reported watching the whole thing. And the increased likelihood of watching a video, I'm reading kind of from the abstract now, there are certain demographics around that. Male, unemployed, and Christian. And they looked at TV exposure to violence, frequency of how often they watch TV, how much they watched violence, and fear of terrorism. They said that it was associated with attentional vigilance, that is a pre-existing fear and a history of violent victimization in the individual, that is exposure to violence in their own lives in some way, and that a fear of terrorism, the fear of becoming the victim of a terrorist attack. And they said, ironically, this fear and distress likely assists the people who engage in these behaviors, ISIS beheadings, for example. It assists them in their very mission, which is to cause us to become more pseudo-vigilant and pseudo-terrorized, so that we are then... a story I'd like to tell is that many, many years ago, during a period of great exposure to terrorist activities, there were all these reports coming in, you know, and I race canoes, and I'm down on the reservoir, the Glenmore Reservoir in Calgary, and one of the people working there goes, God, they rent canoes. And someone had reported that there were some Islamic-looking people out in the reservoir in a canoe, and they were suggesting that they were there for nefarious purposes, perhaps to poison the water or something. So what happens is it accomplishes the very thing the terrorists want, which is increasing, I call it pseudo-vigilance, superstitious acts of vigilance that help us feel safer, but promote nothing but marginalization and negative consequences. In an additional article that I might entitle Score One for Helicopter Parents, it was in Psych Bulletin. The title was The Relationship Between Parents' Involvement in Children's Schooling and Children's Adjustment. And what they found was that the more that the parents were involved in the children's academic circumstance, there were better outcomes in a couple of parameters. One was social and emotional development, and a reduction in antisocial or asocial behavior when they looked at school production and achievement, that homework assistance was negatively associated with achievement, but not engagement and motivation. So children were engaged in school, they were motivated, they were emotionally adjusted, they were socially adjusted and less delinquent, and there was very little difference relative to age, ethnicity, or socioeconomic status in the links between the involvement of parents with the kids. So score one for helicopter parenting. Finally, in an article in Nature, which is a pretty cool place to read articles and pretty credible scientific reports published in Nature, they discovered that spending time in natural environments benefits health and well-being. They looked at about 19,806 people, and it's a ongoing survey that they do relative to the well-being of these individuals, and they found that 120 minutes of time increased well-being and positively associated with health as well, and more time. It seems to it peaked around 200 minutes, 300 minutes a week, meaning there's no further gain. In other words, it isn't that more nature, better you are, but that 120 seems to be the magic one. And it doesn't matter how it's achieved, whether it's achieved in short blocks, a 6 20-minute blocks, or a single long block. This is very interesting because, you know, the Japanese have the concept of forest bathing, which they say promotes health and well-being. But this is kind of an argument for public policy regarding green spaces. I'm lucky I live right off a park in Calgary, Confederation Park. And so there's a lot of, quote, nature that is associated with being in that park. And I walk my dogs in it, and I walk them in it, you know, regardless of forest bathing or nature. But it would argue for greater numbers of green spaces in urban areas. and encouragement of outdoor lifestyles. I can't resist. I did this last one on nature, so I'm letting a hip-hop group, Naughty by Nature, march us out.